Welcome to the Science Update Frogcast. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is the podcast for June 13th, 2008. This week, frogs, salamanders, and other amphibians have faced an alarming extinction crisis for several decades. The numbers are shocking. Worldwide, the populations of over 40% of amphibian species are declining rapidly, and 122 have gone extinct since the 1980s. In response, conservation organizations have designated 2008 as the Year of the Frog to educate the public about amphibian declines and to take action to slow the rate of extinctions in these unique and fascinating creatures. This week, we'll celebrate the Year of the Frog by telling you about some of the exciting recent findings in amphibian biology, from the discovery of the amazing Frogamander fossil to the fearsome Freddy Krueger claws on some African frogs. And we'll update you on what's being done to save amphibians and let you know how you can help. To start us off, Suzanne had a conversation with Brian Gratwick, an amphibian conservation biologist at our own Smithsonian National Zoological Park, right here in Washington, D.C.
So tell me about some of the causes of extinctions. Is it disease? Is it habitat loss? What are some of the things that are contributing to amphibian extinctions around the world?
One of the biggest threats to amphibians is due to habitat loss. One example is in Sri Lanka. About 95% of all of Sri Lanka's original forest cover has been converted to some kind of plantation agriculture, such as tea or rubber or coffee. And today, just 5% of the island's original rainforest is left, but they've also lost 19 species of amphibians. Other things that are particularly worrying are pollution, particularly with pesticides. We know that pesticides can spread up to 600 miles from the point of application, and even in very, very small quantities of 0.1 parts per billion, these pesticides can cause retarded growth, impaired gonad development, and it can make them vulnerable to secondary diseases. If you look at roads, one study in Illinois found that amphibians make up to 93% of all roadkill, and they found a rate of about 7.6 amphibians per kilometer of road per day were being killed. You can also think about other kinds of threats like disease. Our most worrying threat right now is this chytrid fungus, and we're not sure what exactly causes death, but we know that it's very toxic. We know that it tends to attack the skin and start spreading underneath the skin. Chytrid fungus is a huge problem, but where it seems to be causing huge population crashes today are where it's spreading into new populations of amphibians that have never been exposed to it before. And in Australia, particularly in eastern Australia, it caused the extinction of both known species of gastric brooding frogs. So that entire family of amphibians is now extinct due to the chytrid fungus.
Gastric brooding frogs were those frogs you used to hear about in high school biology class that had the weird ability to brood their young right inside their own stomachs. Gratwick says that their extinction highlights how important amphibians are to the health of our own species.
When they have these eggs and tadpoles in their stomachs, they stop producing gastric acid. And it's those chemicals that they were releasing into their stomach to inhibit gastric acid secretion that were potentially very important avenues and lines of research for curing peptic ulcers, which affect millions of people around the world every year.
He adds that we shouldn't underestimate the potential importance of amphibians to medicine.
There is a species of frogs called the white tree frog from Australia, which has a kind of chemical in its skin that has been used in HIV experiments that's been shown to reduce HIV transmission to T cells.
Kisa Nishikawa, a biologist at Northern Arizona University, says one reason frogs are so useful in medicine is because they breathe through their skin. And despite their sensitivity to environmental degradation, they've evolved some pretty powerful defenses that we could learn from.
So what happens is that we're losing potentially some very powerful resources in terms of natural antibiotics that might have very practical use.
And the toxins of the infamous poison dart frogs even help us comprehend the brain.
And these toxins have a variety of biomedical applications in that they're neurotransmitter channel blockers, so we can use them to better understand how neurons function and what kinds of channels they have, as well as there might possibly be some direct biomedical uses of these substances for drug discovery. So I think there's really some practical reasons why we would want to conserve the amphibians.
Nishikawa herself studies cane toads, another amphibian with great biomedical potential. For you taxonomic trivia buffs out there, frogs and toads may look different because they inhabit different environments, but they don't actually make up two separate evolutionary lines.
Toads tend to have dry, sort of warty skin and be active during the day, whereas most frogs have smooth, moister skin and are active at night.
It turns out, toads have some of the fastest tongues in the world, which is pretty handy for catching prey.
The time between when a toad opens its mouth and when its tongue hits the bug is about 20 milliseconds or 1/50th of a second. So it's an extremely fast movement, one of the fastest movements found among animals.
Nishikawa uses high-speed cameras to study their jaw muscles during movement and also measures the muscle's electrical activity.
The muscle starts to be activated about 250 milliseconds, a quarter of a second, before the mouth actually opens. And then they have sort of a catch-and-trigger mechanism in their lower jaws, and they use this to sort of resist mouth opening as the muscle is activated and then let it go suddenly.
This causes the tongue to act like a spring, grabbing unsuspecting insects before they know what's hit them. She adds that understanding toad tongue mechanics could lead to better treatments for neuromuscular diseases and even serve as inspiration for the design of better motors, prosthetic limbs, and even robots in the future.
Thanks, Suzanne. Well, pick up the average frog, and it's unlikely to put up much of a fight. But the hairy frog of Central Africa is a different story. Harvard evolutionary biologist David Blackburn learned this the hard way.
And it got quite a shock when I picked one of them up for the first time and had it kick wildly and rake its bony claws into my skin. Usually when you pick up a frog, there's not too much that happens. Frogs are fairly tame animals. They may kick a little bit. They're usually not too excited about getting picked up. But these frogs can give you a cut deep enough to bleed. Sometimes they'll be an inch or so long. They can just give you these sort of nasty lines of blood that'll sort of just cut right into your skin.
He says the frog's painful claws are formed from a special bone in each of their toes. When disturbed, powerful muscles pull on this bone, causing it to puncture through the skin of the toe. He thinks the claw may have evolved as a defense against predators and adds that this anatomical feature is unique among the vertebrates, and only about a dozen species of frogs from the same family sport the claws. Many of these species are threatened by habitat destruction, and unfortunately, little is being done to conserve the frogs of Cameroon. And Blackburn adds that despite their nasty claws, people in Cameroon and other parts of Central Africa hunt these frogs for food. Other frogs and toads are also hunted by a variety of local cultures around the world for their flesh, and then there's the frog leg trade.
That's right. And the National Zoo's Gratwick says it's big business. And with amphibians in decline, scientists are just beginning to understand the impact that frog harvests might have on their conservation.
On a recent science update, we told you that ancient amphibians are rare in the fossil record, making the origin of modern amphibians a mystery. Well, we have an update. Vertebrate paleontologist Jason Anderson of the University of Calgary and his colleagues recently examined a fossil that was originally discovered in Texas back in 1995.
It shows unique features both of frogs and of salamanders, so it's a little of one, little of the other. That's why we're calling it a frogamander now. I immediately recognized it as something special and something really exciting. What I find coolest about this is that if you took a look at a frog and a salamander, or the first fossils that you see of frogs and salamanders, and you were to say to yourself, I wonder what the common ancestor of these two things might look like, and you started to put a little of A and a little of B together to create this hypothetical common ancestor, you would be very close to the condition that you see in this fossil. So this shows the predictive nature that evolutionary biology and paleontology can have when we have a sufficiently complete fossil record.
The discovery of the frogamander, also known by its scientific name Garabatrachus hottoni, confirms that frogs and salamanders evolved from a single group of ancient amphibians called temnospondyls and diverged from each other a little less than 300 million years ago.
Thanks, Bob. Well, they say don't put all your eggs in one basket, and maybe that sounds trite, but it's still good advice. However, when it comes to reproduction, most animals don't get a choice of where to put their eggs. For instance, scientists once thought that each species of amphibian was locked into laying its eggs either on land or in the water. And the Central American hourglass tree frog was thought to be no exception.
Hourglass tree frogs are a neotropical species, a rainforest species, and they've been known for a long time to lay their eggs terrestrially on vegetation overhanging ponds, and then the tadpoles fall into the water when they hatch. And we've only ever seen them laying eggs terrestrially, attached to vegetation over the water.
That's biologist Karen Workington of Boston University. But she and her colleague Justin Touchon recently discovered that contrary to conventional wisdom, some of the frogs were actually laying eggs directly in the water.
What we found is that they actually are capable of laying eggs both terrestrially and aquatically. And this is probably not unique to these frogs, but it's the first case that's been found for a frog, or indeed any vertebrate, to be able to lay eggs both on land and in water. Because if you think about it, land and water are very different environments for a developing egg. Most animals that lay terrestrial eggs, if you put their eggs into the water, the embryos will drown. And similarly, most eggs that are normally laid in the water, if those eggs are taken out of the water, they dry out and the eggs die. They're not as good at surviving either in land or in water as eggs that are really specialized for one environment, but they have the capacity for doing both. These eggs are small, so they don't need as much oxygen, and they also have a larger surface area to volume ratio, so it's easier for oxygen to get into them. So that makes them less likely to drown compared to a larger terrestrial egg.
And speaking of frog reproduction, biologists will need to learn a lot more about it in coming years, according to the National Zoo's Gratwick. That's because one way to stave off extinctions is through captive breeding.
One of the ways we can help as zoos and aquaria is to get organized and to buy ourselves some more time. And one of the most exciting projects around today is the Amphibian Ark program, which is encouraging all the zoos and aquaria around the world to take in just one species of amphibian into captivity and manage it in a sound way for conservation, so that if they do go extinct in the wild, that we still have some left. One of those species is the Panamanian golden frog, and it is now extinct in the wild. But we have about 120 Panamanian golden frogs at the National Zoo, managed out of a population of about 2,000 animals that are in captivity. But what we're really doing with the Amphibian Ark program is trying to buy us some time to stop these amphibians from going extinct before it's too late, so we don't have to have 100 more examples of the gastric brooding frogs of Australia.
When we think about captive breeding, we often think about trying to figure out how to get cheetahs to breed with each other or having enough space for large charismatic species. What are the challenges and what are some of the things that make it easier to do captive breeding with amphibians?
Well, amphibians are a great species to do captive breeding. For a start, they don't need a lot of space. They're cold-blooded, so they don't need a lot of food. They're also really great because most of them are very, very prolific reproducers. So part of the captive management issues are, can we reproduce them in enough quantities to maintain their captive population, but not let their captive populations go out of control? There are many reasons why captive breeding programs are important. Without many of these captive breeding programs, there's a very famous quote by Aldo Leopold, one of the fathers of conservation, and he says, "To keep every cog and wheel is the first rule of intelligent tinkering." I think we should be using captive breeding almost as a last resort. And the desired situation is to have healthy populations of amphibians preserved in the wild in perpetuity. But the reality of the world that we live in today means that some of these threats just are insurmountable, And the only option that we have is to take them into captivity and ensure that they survive into the future.
In addition to captive breeding, conservation groups are also working to identify and preserve the only remaining habitat for certain amphibian species.
Areas of just a few square kilometers or a few hundred square kilometers that contain virtually all of a single species distribution.
And conservation groups aren't doing this alone. The Year of the Frog is just as much about educating the public as it is about conservation efforts. To learn more about how you can get involved in saving amphibians around the world, log on to www.amphibianarc.org.
Thanks, Suzanne. Well, that's our show for this week. Next time, the Science Update podcast will be taking a journey in time and space. We'll tell you how the weather changed the course of history during Magellan's famous circumnavigation of the globe. We'll look at ancient Mexican life through the lens of modern satellites, and we'll tell you about a brand new telescope that's showing us the universe in a whole new light. Until then, visit our website and listen to our Science Update Podcast Daily Edition. We've got a stellar new science story every day, Monday through Friday. You can find it on our website or at iTunes. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.